हरिः ॐ सहनवतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः ॐ जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिव सरि गौर भक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे
Page 3, the Bhagavad Misunderstood. Riti. In this section, the author presents different reasons and causes for misunderstanding the Bhagavad. Also, he discusses how various philosophers, according to different time, place, and circumstances, pursue their quest for the one absolute truth, and finally delineates the attitude of a true critic that can attain success in the search of the absolute truth. Right? So you have how people get off track. At the same time, you have to be able to see what is of value, what is on track. Because you want to keep what's correct, but you want to remove what's improper. Right? So then he's going to show how the true critic can see the difference there. Right? Because if there's any fault, then the shallow critic is just going to throw everything out.
Only the Vaishnavas can be true critics.
Only the Vaishnavas can be true critics. It means when you're dealing with these in the spiritual, yes.
Yes.
Okay, one. The Bhagavat, like all religious works and philosophical performances and writings of great men, has suffered from the imprudent conduct of useless readers and stupid critics. Okay. Okay, shallow critic and stupid critic, they're synonyms. Okay. Men of brilliant thoughts have passed by the work in quest of truth and philosophy. But the prejudice which they imbibed from its useless readers and their conduct, i.e. sahajiyas, prevented them from making a candid investigation. Right? Because if the sahajiyas are then following the Bhagavat, then those individuals, you know, of intellect and culture will avoid them. Because it means, just look at it here. The sahajiya aspect, you know, in this case, then we're looking at we're looking at someone who doesn't accept authority. Right? You don't need to study. You don't need to accept shastras and rules and regulations. Right? And it's just the mood, the bhav. That's all it takes for success. Right? That's basically there. That's why it's called sahajiya. It means it's easy. Right? So then the problem comes down is that anybody who's actually intelligent and, you know, what we would call successful in the world, you know, that are thoughtful, then they know it's only by regulation, it's only by following the rules, it's only by knowledge and application that you get success. Right? So unless you're an impersonalist, that whatever's going on in karma then in spiritual, it's exact opposite, right? We have forms of spiritual means, no forms like that. You know, you understand? But the problem is it's not intellectual. It's just sentimental. And since when is just because you want it, it happens. You know what I'm saying? You have to make the endeavor. But with sahajiyas, there's no endeavor. They just experience. Right? Even if you take it, you know, you have the, you know, standard theme where the where the lead character in the story, then there's something that is burning, you know, something in their, you know, in their heart. So then they spend the whole story trying to obtain that, you know, like Brunhilde or something, right? Does that make sense? Yeah. So, but the point is are they making an endeavor? Right? Is he getting through the ring of fire? Is he fighting the dragon? Is he... He's not?
Yes.
Means he's making an endeavor. But then the Sahajiyas are saying, you don't need to make an endeavor, you'll just automatic. So that's what I'm meaning. The intelligent person knows, even if you're working on a passion, he still takes endeavor, still takes knowledge. It's still, you have to follow the rules. Right? Does that make sense? So, therefore, if you have people like the Sahajiyas studying Bhagavat and professing Bhagavat, then would an intelligent person want to go near the Bhagavat? You understand? That's the whole, that's what Bhaktivinoda Thakur is dealing with. Is that the Sahajiyas have kind of taken over the whole scene. They're known as the Gaudiyas. So the real Gaudiyas aren't seen by the intelligent people. Because they'll be out of the way. Just like the intelligent person stays out of the way. The common person's out on the street. So the bona fide Vaishnavas stay out of the way. And then you have these common, you know, people acting however they act. Does that make sense? So this is the scenario in which he's there. So, yes, we can say this and that, but the point is we may say that, yes, in the modern we also have to, you know, please these people. But no, we just have to do what we do. Automatically, that would be interesting to them. Because we have tradition, we have knowledge, we have practices, and they are effective. You can see the results. It's not maybe, it's they have results because you're dealing with Krishna. Right? So that will automatically attract the attention of those who are intelligent. Right? That's what it says. Those who are intelligent in this age will worship Lord Chaitanya through the Sankirtan mission. Those who are not intelligent, they won't. So. 2. Truth does not belong exclusively to any individual man or to any nation or particular race. It belongs to God, and man, whether in poles or on the equator, has a right to claim it as the property of his father. Right? So here we're pointing out, because we'll generally take it, oh, the truth is from here, is from there, or this one has, or that individual. It's not. Truth belongs to God. Right? Krishna, one of his names is Tattva. He is truth. So the Bhagavatam opens with knowing truth means knowing Krishna. Right? So, yeah. So when you start with that, the truth belongs to God, and there's only one God, then you have a specific, approach to the truth. Right? Does that make sense? It's not made up by man. It's not, that's why the problem came up with the Ionians of, it's the vox populi. Right? It's relative. It means if we all here together say, you know, something is true, that makes it true. Whether it is or not. But it just means amongst us, we say it's good. And for our circle, that's all that matters. Right? So this is a problem. No, because truth is already existing. Truth is the absolute. We have to then learn that, bring our life in line with that. Right? Does that make sense? So there's laws in that, but those laws come from God. The Bhagavad has suffered alike from shallow critics, both Indian and foreign. That book has been accursed and denounced by a great number of young countrymen who have scarcely read its contents and pondered over the philosophy on which it is founded. It is owing mostly to their imbibing an unfounded prejudice against it when they were in school under the British. The Bhagavat, as a matter of course, has been held in derision by those teachers who are generally of an inferior mind and intellect. Right? You know, because there's the saying, if you can't do it, then you teach. Right? That's the Western Academy. You can't actually, just like, you can't do business, so then you teach the MA course. Right? Because if you could actually apply what you knew, why would you be working on that small salary? Does that make sense? Yeah. So that's that. Therefore, you can't say, oh, that's just that he's just saying that inferior mind and intellect. No, even in the Western Academy, they say that. Right? If you can't do it, you teach, and if you can't teach, you teach the teachers, or you teach PE. Right, you know, these are your options. Oh, what a trouble to get rid of prejudice gathered in unripe years. As far as we can understand, no enemy of Vaishnavism will find any beauty in the Bhagavad. The true critic is a generous judge, devoid of prejudices and party spirit. The critic, in other words, should be of the same disposition of mind of that of the author whose merits he is required to judge. Right? Because even in the modern academy, is that you make your dissertation, you are judged by a group of peers. Right? Not below you, by peers. So if you don't appreciate the Bhagavad, you can't, therefore, look at it to judge it. Right? You can't write on that level. You can't do it. It's improper. So, you know, it's just like how, you know, it's how you say, you know, your standard thing is the guys sit around and, you know, they're watching the football game. They have so many things. He should have done this. He could have done that. All these things. They, you know, if you just listened to them, everything would have just gone perfect. Right? But there's a good chance that, you know, walking out of the pub, they'll trip. Right? You know, let alone being able to kick a ball. You know what I'm saying? So that's the whole thing. Everybody's got to comment on politics, on sports, on economics, everything. But the point is how many of them can do it? So is that, that's a shallow critic. They don't even know what they're talking about. Thoughts have different ways. Both the Christian and the Vaishnava may, for instance, utter the same sentiment, but they will never stop fighting with each other because they've arrived at their common conclusion by different ways of thought. Subjects of philosophy and theology are like the peaks of large, towering, and inaccessible mountains standing in the midst of our planet, inviting attention and investigation. Thinkers and men of deep speculation take their observations through the instruments of reason and consciousness. But they take different points when they carry on their work. These points are positions chalked out by the circumstances of their social and philosophical life, different as they are in different parts of the world. Right? So, depending where you are, they have different values, different aspects, you know, in the way they eat, they dress, their language, how they express their feelings, all these different things. Because of that, they take different angles. Right? So naturally, taking different conditioned angles, their approach is going to be different. Even though if they come up with the same conclusion, they're still going to fight with each other because being shallow, they only see that much. They see their method is as the method, but it's based on being conditioned. Right? So the Vedic, therefore, is based on the Aptas, the great souls, who are not conditioned. Therefore, there will just be one community of thought. Does that make sense? So based on that, then we approach. So it's not our opinion. Right? These others is their opinion. This is not our opinion. It's the direction of the Acharyas. So we follow that. Plato looked at the peak of the spiritual question from the west, and Vyasa made the observation from the east. So Confucius did it from further east. And how do you say Schlegel? Schlegel? S-C-H? Yes. In German? Schlegel? Spinoza, Kant, and?
Goethe.
Huh?
Goethe.
Goethe. Goethe. Not a goat. Did he have that little goatee? So they just called as you see him. Okay, he looks like a goat. So Goethe. From further west, these observations were made at different times and by different means. But the conclusion is all the same inasmuch as the object of our observation was one and the same. They all hunted after the Great Spirit, the unconditioned soul of the universe, the absolute religion. So they're all looking at this, but because of their conditioning, they'll only see certain things. It requires a candid, generous, pious, and holy heart to feel the beauties of their conclusions. Party spirit, that great enemy of truth, will always baffle the attempt of the inquirer who tries to gather truth from religious works of other nations, and will make him believe that absolute truth is nowhere except in his own religious books. The critic, therefore, should have a comprehensive, good, generous, candid, impartial, and sympathetic soul. Right? Then you can see. You can see what is of value. But the point is having seen all these points that may be of value in all these other philosophies, you'll see all that in the Bhagavad. Therefore, of all these approaches, it's the superior. But it's not that the other ones, inasmuch as what is on the absolute platform, that's good. And what's not, that's just due to their particular conditioning. So you take what's useful. So from there, you can start and bring it forward. Does that make sense? Okay. What is the Bhagavad? Riti. The author here gives a lucid description of how people belonging to different non-devotional backgrounds possess an incorrect outlook of the Srimad Bhagavatam. 1. The traveling companion of a European gentleman newly arrived in India will tell him with a serene look that the Bhagavat is a book which the Uriya bearer daily reads in the evening to a number of hearers. It contains a jargon of unintelligible and savage literature of those men who paint their noses with some sort of earth or sandal and wear beads all over their body in order to procure salvation for themselves. Right? So this is how they look at it. Right? Another of his companions, who has traveled a little in the interior, would immediately contradict him and say that the Bhagavat is a Sanskrit word claimed by a sect of men, the Goswamis, who give mantras, like the popes of Italy, to the common people of Bengal, and pardon their sins on payment of gold enough to defray their social expenses. 3. A young Bengali chained up in English thoughts and ideas, and wholly ignorant of the pre-Mohammedan history of his own country, will add one more explanation by saying that the Bhagavad is a book containing an account of the life of Krishna, who was an ambitious and immoral man. This is all he could gather from his grandmother, while yet he did not go to school. So when he's very young, he's got this from his grandmother. Right? Then that's further when he goes to school. 4. Thus the great Bhagavat never remains unknown to the foreigners, like the elephant of the 6 blind who caught hold of the several parts of the body of the beast. But truth is eternal and never injured, but for a while by ignorance. Okay. Yeah, so in other words, these blind men, they're all dealing with the absolute truth, but they see it in a different way.
Yes. Can we classify and say that, for example, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, his main opponents were the Sahajiyas and those influenced by the British?
Basically, those influenced by Western thought. But even within the Vedic, you know, there would be ones that would be a problem, but the most would be those who have that Western education.
And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati would be his main targets?
That would be the Goswamis.
And Srila Prabhupada?
His godbrothers.
And us?
I will leave that up to you. Right, in other words, those that were rooted in Western thought, like that, you know, and then the Sahajis on the other side, they're the ones that were making trouble for Bhaktivinoda Thakur's preaching. The Goswamis made the trouble for Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. Srila Prabhupada's godbrothers made trouble for him. He's trying to pull everything together, work together as one unit, but they have to have their own little flag somewhere on their little, you know, like that. And so they couldn't hold it together. Does that make sense? Yeah.
I was just continuing.
You were just thinking, and yeah. I say, yeah, my enemy's the, what do you call it? The supplier. He never brings the stuff on time, and lunch is always late. Okay. So, do we see here his example? You have the 6 blind men. They're approaching the same absolute truth, like he gave the example before of the mountain. They're all looking towards the same mountain, studying the same mountain, but they're going by their own conditioning by trying to interpret what the mountain is. But the point is what they're interpreting, you take that and bring it into light of the actual position And then you can just move forward from there. You don't say the whole thing you have to remove. It's a matter of what they value, that's the one you take, and then what's the real value? You know? Because it's just like, let's say if we take, you know, what do you call it? You know, it's a jargon, unintellectual and savage literature, a man who paint their noses with some kind of earth or sandal and wear beads all over their bodies in order to procure salvation for themselves. But this is, if you take the same angle, you take... if we have a medical journal, would you be able to understand it? No, it's got all this fun, unintelligible jargon. And these guys, what they do for a living is cut people up. Right? And they go to work in their pajamas. Right? And they're so embarrassed that they wear a thing over their face so that no one can actually tell who they are. You know what I'm saying? It's easy to do that. So if that's how you're going to do, is that actually intelligent? So from there, you just go, you value that it's intelligent. So is that an intelligent approach? You want people to be cultured. Is that actually culture? Are you actually seeing the culture? So, does that make sense? You take the principle that they're looking for. So they're looking for something that is intelligible. It's accessible. It's not savage. It's cultured. Right? And they're not doing something weird. There's some meaning to it. Does that make sense? Like that. So, yeah. So then when you show the actual what's happening, what is the tradition, what is the things, and what they're for, then that person should appreciate. If they just want to criticize, it doesn't matter what you say, they'll criticize it. Then that's not an insincere person. So that in the preaching, they're left because they're not interested. But if it's just they've heard these things, they're doing like that, then you... Does that make sense? So you're taking what they value. You know? And then, like here, the next one is that the Sanskrit is like this. You know, it has these things. It has some similarities. But, you know, and they defray their social expenses by pardoning the sins. So they see something there. So that's a problem there. It's also a problem here. Because their church, you know, was doing that or is doing that. So that's a problem. So you want to come to a higher standard. Because that is the higher religious standard. So you can say, yes, you do have that, wherever you are. But there is the standard. Does that make sense? And then you talk about ambitious, he's moral, but point is he doesn't have, and Gita says he doesn't have any of these qualities. Right? Because it's all his anyway. So what's the meaning of trying to take it over? It's already his. So he doesn't have to do anything. He's the one who sets the rules. And the rules are to be in connection with him. So if you're interacting with him, that's the perfection of the rules. So you're just taking what they're already doing, seeing what they appreciate or don't appreciate. Because if they're not appreciating, it means there's most likely the opposite. Then you go down that. Does that make sense? So you're trying to get to the essence of what they're talking about. Does that make sense? Yeah. The Bhagavat explains itself, Riti. Now the author presents the proper perception of the Bhagavatam by reciting from the excerpts from the Bhagavatam comprising the revelations gained by Lord Brahma and Vyasadeva in trance. Right, because Vyasadeva after speaking to Narad, and then Narad was inquiring from Brahma in the second canto, then about, you know, who's the supreme, and then Brahma's giving his realizations. One, it is the fruit of the tree of thought, Vedas, mixed with the nectar of the speech of Sukadeva. It is the temple of spiritual love. It is composed of 18,000 shlokas. It contains the best part of the Vedas and Vedanta. The Bhagavat is preeminently, quote-unquote, the book, in India, right? So therefore we shouldn't make other books and call it the book, because Bhagavatam is the book, right? Once enter into it, and you are transplanted, as it were, into the spiritual world where gross matter has no existence. The true follower of the Bhagavat is the spiritual man who has already cut his temporary connection with the phenomenal nature, and has made himself the inhabitant of that region where God eternally exists and loves. This mighty work is founded upon inspiration, and its superstructure is upon reflection. To the common reader, it has no charms and is full of difficulty. We are, therefore, obliged to study it deeply through the assistance of such great commentators as Sridhar Swami and Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and his contemporary followers. 3. Now Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the great preacher of Nadia, who has been adulated by his talented followers, tells us that the Bhagavad is founded upon the four verses which Vyas received from Narada, the most learned of created beings. Right? Can we see, and Narada received them from Brahma, and Brahma received them from Krishna. Right? He tells us further that Brahma pierced through the whole universe of matter for years and years in quest of the final cause of the world. But when he failed to find it abroad, he looked into the construction of his own spiritual nature. And there he heard the universal spirit speaking unto him. Quote, I was in the beginning before all spiritual and temporal things were created. And after they have been created, I am in them all in the shape of their existence and truthfulness. Right, so that means their existence and their nature, right? So the aspect of what is there in them that makes them what they are, and then the form of that therefore can act to express that original nature. Krishna's both of that. And when they will all be gone, I shall remain full as I was and as I am. So he's separate from that, right? He's not bringing that up now. Whatever appears to be true without being a real fact itself, and whatever is not perceived, though it is true in itself, are objects of my illusory energy of creation, such as light and darkness in the material world. Right, so something's true, but we take it that something will make us happy, but it won't. So we're saying it's a truth, but it's not a truth. Or there is truth, means you have the absolute truth, devotional service, that understanding of Vedanta. But we don't see that, we see something else. So both of these, that's illusion. So we take something else as the truth, or we don't actually see the real truth. Right? 5. Like Brahma, Vyas also fell back into his own self and searched his own spiritual nature. And then it was that the above truth was communicated to him for his own good and the good of the world. The sage immediately perceived that his former works required supersession, inasmuch as they did not contain the whole truth and nothing but the truth. In his new idea, he obtained the development of his former idea of religion. He commenced the Bhagavat in pursuance of this change. Right, so the basic things that are there before, he's taking it forward. Right, we're not dropping something. He's just taking it forward. Sambandha Abhideyam Prayojana. Riti. Now the author delineates the content of Srimad Bhagavatam in terms of Sambandha Abhideya Prayojana. 1. The whole of this incomparable work teaches us, according to our great Chaitanya, the three great truths which compose the absolute religion of man. Right, so this means this Sambandha Abhideya Prayojana, this is man's religion. Right? And so then the details of that, how you apply that, those are the different facets of religion. Our Nadia preacher calls them Sambandha Abhideya and Prayojana. In other words, the relation between the creator and the created, the duty of man to God, and the prospectus of humanity. Or prospects of humanity. Right? So it's always the relation between creator and created. It means you're talking about the Lord and the living entity and the material energy. But you also have to understand the relationship. Right? So that's going to be the Achinta Bheda Bheda Tattva. Right? Then you're going to have the details in Tattva of Krishna, his energies, and the Jivas. And then the duty of man, because then Abhideya means applying that duty. Just knowledge of that, that'll be in Sambandha, but using that, applying that, that's Abhideya. Then the prospects, what you can gain from that application. Right? So what are the gains you can get for humanity? Because eating, sleeping, mating, defending is already there for the animals. And so now we're looking for something beyond that. Two, in these three worlds, is summed up as the whole ocean of human knowledge as far as it has been explored up to this era of human progress. These are the cardinal points of religion. And the whole Bhagavat is, as we are taught by Sri Chaitanya, an explanation, both by precepts and examples, of these three great points. Oh, in these three words, not worlds, okay, words, is summed up the whole idea of human knowledge, right? So this is the basis. So Vedic study, Vedic knowledge is always on these. You always have to be able to see what sambandha, abhidaya, and prayoga. So all aspects of the knowledge, philosophy, practice fits into this. Right? Because these three are the essence of the whole body of knowledge. Right? So that approach through that, trying to understand through tradition, through the Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra, that approach, that you're trying to go deep, not shallow, that makes the Vedic academy. Does that make sense? Like that. While the modern is a shallow, it's just facts and figures that you memorize. Right? That's it. There is no conclusion. This idea, it's all sambandha, abhidaya, and prayoga, and that's not there. People come up with different things and put it together in different ways, and you know, that's the fun of it. But it'll always remain shallow because unless you follow this, it won't go deep. Does that make sense? Unless you get in the pool, can you go deep? Standing on the side or sitting in your chair on the side, you know, can you go deep? No. Sambandha. One. Throughout the Bhagavat, teaches us there is only one God without a second, who is full in himself and is and will remain the same. Time and space, which prescribe conditions to created objects, are much below his supreme spiritual nature, which is unconditioned and absolute. Two, Maya intervenes between us and God as long as we are not spiritual. And when we are able to break off her bonds, we, even in this mortal frame, learn to communicate in our spiritual nature with the unconditioned and absolute. No, Maya does not mean a false thing only. It means concealment of eternal truth as well. That's why he said it's those two aspects. You don't see what's the real truth, or you take something else as truth. Right? So, that the truth is covered, and being covered, you don't see the truth. Both these aspects. The creation is not Maya itself, but is subject to that principle. Right? So the creation is not Maya, it's just Krishna's inferior energy. But it's subject to Maya. The true idealist must be a dualist also. He must believe that all he perceives as nature created by God, full of spiritual essence and relations, but he must not believe that the outward appearance is the truth. The Bhagavad teaches us that we healthily perceive, that all we healthily perceive is true, but its material appearance is transient and illusory. So in other words, what we're seeing is there, but it's temporary and illusory, that we think it is what we say it is. No, it's because it's Krishna's potency. It's his nature. So it actually exists. So here then we're talking about the dualist means you have to be able to see God and his creation. Right? You have to be able to see the two. Though, we'll see later that they're non-different. Right? Four, nature is eternally spiritual, but the intervention of Maya makes her gross and material. Man, in his progress, attempts to shake off this gross ideal, childish and foolish in its nature, and by subduing the intervening principle of Maya, lives in continual union with God in his spiritual nature. The Bhagavad teaches us this relation between man and God. This is called Sambandha Gyan of the Bhagavad. Or in other words, the knowledge of the relations between the conditioned and the absolute. Right? So that's the Sambandha Gyan. You're teaching all those aspects. So you're saying you're talking about the living entity. It means you're talking about Krishna and the created, and the created is the material energy, you know, and the living entity. So, yeah. Yes, so you notice the language here, this is language that you could talk to anybody, at least that can deal with some language. But you understand? That's the whole point, but he's only speaking the sambandhagyan. This is what we're meaning. And so, you see, is when you do that, it's automatically intelligent. It's automatically logical. Yes. Right? Now, if the person can function on this level of language and be able to appreciate it and relate to it, then that's fine. If not, you adjust the language so that they can, but you don't change the method. I mean, the message. Does that make sense? That's all you're doing. That's why you see is that in here, because you're working with the Victorian English and all that, and people were generally all educated like that, that would work in these circles. So then he's speaking, Bhaktivinoda Thakur is speaking this language. Prabhupada's making it for a more general public, you know, in the contemporary time. Right? So Bhaktivinoda Thakur's general public was more educated, you could say, in the literary sense. And the contemporary is not. So therefore then, Prabhupada's language will be different. But the message is exactly the same. Right? That's why there's no contradiction. But if we come into it from our conditioning, we'll say, oh, Prabhupada's saying one thing, Bhaktivinoda Thakur is saying another, because the words are different. But that's shallow. Right? You have to see what's being spoken.
Maharaj, there is a need to have the right attitude as
yes.
a student.
Yes.
And also to understand the different perspectives about
yes, yes.
The message.
Yes, yes, yes. Yes. Because the point is the Bhagavat philosophy is the highest of philosophies. So if you're explaining it, you understand it and are explaining it, it's always going to be intellectual, it's always going to be logical. So one doesn't have to worry about that.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
You speak from what you understand.
Yes.
Right? Because either you speak something you don't understand, there'll be a problem. Speak what you understand. It means yes. Speak about those aspects why you're convinced of devotional service.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right? And then that will have effect.
Yes.
Abhideya. The second great principle inculcated by the Bhagavat is the principle of duty. Man must spiritually worship his God. There are three ways in which the Creator is worshipped: by the created, according to the condition of their mind, as Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. Those who worship God as infinitely great in the principle of admiration call him by the name of Brahman. This mode is called jnana, or knowledge. Right? So then we're seeing it's being mentioned about all these great personalities before. And you'll see is that many of many of those that he mentioned, they'll be talking about knowledge. God is just knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The infinite, the absolute, the supreme, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll only be observing those aspects. Right? So it's not that they're wrong on one level, but this is all the farther they're dealing with it. And because they're using their own speculation, therefore it won't be complete even their understanding of what they do see. Those who worship God as a universal soul in the principle of spiritual union with him give him the name of Paramatma. This is yoga. Right, so you see, as most world religions that do accept a personal God, this is the approach that they'll use. Right? He's the universal soul, like that. This is yoga. And those who worship God as all in all with their heart, body, and strength style him as Bhagavan. Right? Because then it's about a person, you as a person serving him as a person. Not that he's the supreme soul, the spirit, you know, the principle of spiritual union, all these different things, he's you know, God. So that makes sense. So Bhagavan he is, but then there's that aspect. This last principle is bhakti. So you see, a few people, so between the Paramatma and Bhagavan, generally there's not so much of a problem, just that people by default will work in one or the other. But it's not that you can't mention the other, but then they'll see it in the context of their perspective. You talk about the Bhagavan platform, someone on the Paramatma platform will just see it in the context of Paramatma. Right? And someone in the Bhagavan platform, you talk about Paramatma, they'll see it in context of Bhagavan. The person on the Brahman platform, they're the one that may not appreciate the other aspects. But you'll see that that aspect is appreciated by those who understand Brahman or Paramatma, Paramatma or Bhagavan. The book that prescribes the relation and worship of Bhagavan procures for itself the name Bhagavat, and the worshiper is also called by the same name. Right? So, since they're all worshiping on these different levels, then the Bhagavat is what then is bringing out the relationship between the Lord and the living entity in bhakti. So it's bringing out that highest approach to the Lord, free from, you know, any other platform. Right? 3. The superiority of the Bhagavat consists in the uniting of all sorts of theistic worship into one excellent principle in human nature, which passes by the name of bhakti. This word has no equivalent in the English language. Piety, devotion, resignation, and spiritual love, unalloyed with any sort of petition, except in the way of repentance, compose the highest principle of bhakti. Right, so there's no equivalent. It means it's all these things together. It's all included in there. That's why we say is that bhakti includes the other things. Does that make sense? It's already there. It's not that it's something else. No, bhakti means that it includes everything. It's just like you have Brahman understanding. Paramatma already includes Brahman. Right? And Bhagavan includes Paramatma and Brahman. So if you have Bhagavat, you have the other two. The Bhagavat tells us to worship God in that great and invaluable principle, which is infinitely superior to human knowledge and the principle of yoga. Right? So, just on the platform of jnana and on yoga, these connections with the Lord, Bhagavat platform is beyond that. 4. The principle of bhakti passes through 5 distinct stages in the course of its development into its highest and purest form. Then again, it reaches the last form. It is susceptible of further progress from the stage of prema, love, to that of mahabhava. Right? So, one is developing it up to that platform of prema, and then from prema, it can continue more. Right? Okay. It's susceptible of further progress from the stage of prema, love, to that of mahabhava, which is in fact a complete transition into the spiritual universe where God alone is the bridegroom of our soul. The voluminous Bhagavat is nothing more than a full illustration of this principle of continual development and progress of the soul from gross matter to the all-perfect universal spirit who is designated as personal, eternal, absolutely free, all-powerful, and all-intelligent. Okay, then. Matter as a dictionary of spirit. So it's within this same section.
Subcategory.
Oh, it's a subcategory. This is within Abhideya?
Yeah.
Or,
within Abhideya it's a subcategory.
Okay, so it's just giving definitions of the terminologies.
Yeah.
Okay. 5. In the Bhagavat, comparisons have been made with the material world, which cannot help but convince the ignorant and the impractical. Material examples are absolutely necessary for the explanation of spiritual ideas. The Bhagavat believes that the spirit of nature is the truth in nature and is the only practical part of it. Right? So, here is that you're saying matter as a dictionary spirit means that when you're explaining something, the spiritual aspect, then you need to be able to give an example. That example will always be within the material context, right? Because you're dealing with the ignorant and the impractical, right? Because practical means you're working with God's creation, understanding God. That's practical. Working with God's creation, not understanding God, means you don't actually know what you're dealing with. Does that make sense? You know, like that. So that's the problem, is that we don't know what we're working with. So therefore, material examples are absolutely necessary. So you see in the process was the upadana means you're going to give an example. Right? And that's what's going to get the example across. Like you see, Bhaktivinoda Thakur mentions the mountain to show the example of where they're looking from. So it's the same mountain, but they're looking at it from different directions. You know, so the Far Eastern thought is looking at the West, Middle Eastern thought, the Western thought. They're all thinking of these things, right? Or the elephant, that you have the blind men, they're trying to figure out what an elephant is, but they're taking different parts. One has the tail, you know, so the elephant's like a snaky thing with kind of a fan on the end. You know, one is the leg, so it's like a tree. You know, another one is the ear, so it's like a bird. Another one is this nose, so they don't even know what that is. You know, the big fat snake or something like that. Does that make sense? Someone else, the body, you know, so it's like a big, yeah, big ball, you know, like that. So that's the difficult. So without an example, we don't catch. So, but the point is why is that? Because God and His creation are non-different. So the absolute truth is in all of these aspects. So the example should bring out that aspect. So that makes it practical to what you're doing. That's why you use the right example. One, it has to be illustrating the point being made. And two, it has to be in line with the understanding that the person you're speaking with will appreciate. So, yeah.
Nice is like preaching.
Preaching, yes. Yeah, means there's always a discussion of trying to, if you're trying to elevate yourself, then that's done through association. So that's done by discussion. So in this discussion, then one's naturally going to have to bring out the aspects about Krishna using example. You make your point, you give your reasons, and then you have to give an example. Right? But having given the example, that's not where it ends. Now you have to bring it back, you know, to show and then show how to practically apply it. So we see is here is that the Bhagavad believes that the spirit of nature is the truth in nature. Right? So nature, meaning the material nature, the actual truth in nature, or the material creation, is the spirit of nature, which is Krishna. He's the actual, who's behind. Does that make sense? He's the Paramatma of the material world. He's what makes it work. And is the only practical part of it. What works, that's Krishna. You know what I'm saying? Yes. So that's the point. It's like, let's say we have a car. What defines a car?
The wheels.
It has wheels. Okay. So does that mean that the homie down on the corner is a car because he's got wheels?
Lots of parts combined,
like your bag there. You understand? So, what makes the car unique?
To travel from one place to
another. It travels from one place to another, but it's defined that it's enclosed, it has four wheels. Does a bicycle also get one place to another, but it's only got two wheels? You know what I'm saying? So that's the whole point of the definition should be exact enough. So the point is now if you have a car, an old junk car is sitting out in the backyard since the last 40 years, right? There's no wheels and all that, and the doors have fallen off, and there's no, you know, like that. It sits out. The kids like to go out there and play in it, like that. You know, but you can say it's a car because it kind of has that form, but is it practical? No, because the real thing is the car has to move you from point A to point B. So that practical part of it, that's what is Krishna. You know, and then, as Prabhu mentioned, all the parts, it's many, many different parts. But the practicalness of each part and what it does in relation to the car, that's also Krishna. Right? Does that make sense? What was the other definition? It's got four wheels, right? So, point is, Krishna is the one that is the practicalness of the wheel, how the wheel works. Now, why wheels? Why aren't they square or something? You know what I'm saying? It may not work out as good. Yeah. Give me a minute. I'll go around and I'll pull my squares up here. You know? Like that. It's not going to work. Right?
So everything that we use, everything that's there in the definition, any aspect, the practical point is what's Krishna. The windshield wipers that they wipe that and do work, that's Krishna. If they don't, the windshield wipers go back and forth and nothing happens, you'll say there's some problem here. Does that make sense? Yeah. I said the wipers on the bus have to go, what's it? Swish, 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 right? If they just go creak, 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 then there's something wrong. Right? No?
Yes.
Okay. So that means that matter is a dictionary, a spirit, if you understand how to use it. Just like a dictionary, you have to know how to use it. Six, the phenomenal appearance of nature is truly theoretical. Although it has had the greatest claim upon our belief from the days of infancy, the outward appearance of nature is nothing more than a sure index of its spiritual face.
What does it mean? It's truly theoretical?
Or reading. Comparisons are therefore necessary. Nature, as it is before our eyes, must explain the spirit, or else the truth will ever remain concealed. Remember, because he mentions that you're just seeing the external, not seeing the truth. That's illusion. And that the truth is covered by that nature, and not seeing it is also illusion. Right? Or else the truth will ever remain concealed, and man will never rise from his boyhood through his whiskers and beard grow white as the snows of the Himalayas. Right? So it's by his whiskers and his beard growing white, that's not going to what's going to rise him from boyhood. Right? Important element. The other day I was talking to one of the boys, and he was, after going out of the school and all that, so he would have been like 22, 23, like that. He went back to his place and somehow another came up that they asked him to be the temple president. Now, because in the small community, everyone else did it and no one wanted to do it anymore. So then here's a new face, okay, you be the president. Right? So then he was the president for some time. And I asked him, so, you know, how did it go? And he says, I've realized one thing. He says, dealing with the kids and dealing with the adults is exactly the same thing, just the adults have a bigger ego. You know? And then the main problem is what 60-year-old wants to listen to a 20-year-old? So that, therefore, he decided after, you know, 9 months that it's not going to work. Because he could do it, that's not the problem, but no one wants to listen because he's only 20. Even though all those 60-year-olds were 20 at one time and running temples. And they'll talk about the good old days and, you know, that's... You know, yeah. So, that's Bhaktivinoda Thakur's point. Is that just by growing a beard and the beard turning white, that's not rising one from boyhood. You know? Does that make sense? You just have more experience, that's all. You know, it's kind of like Stewie or something, like, you know. That makes sense? No? Okay. So, therefore, the phenomenal appearance of nature is truly theoretical, because what we were saying before from the Vedic psychology, right, is everybody can only observe something according to the nature they have. Right? So according to the modes of nature, you see something in a particular way. Yes. So what can be seen, that's all different. Yes. So it's theoretical. What you're seeing is what it is. That's one aspect. The other aspect is what is practical about it, what you're seeing, that's Krishna. Yes. So simply the phenomenal appearance, that's theoretical. That's not the real thing. It's what it does because it's Krishna. That's the real thing. Does that make sense? Yeah.
But knowledge for that, we need to develop goodness. For getting to that level, we need to develop goodness.
Need to develop goodness, but still, even beyond goodness, because those in goodness can still make a mistake because they're still seeing from the perspective of goodness.
Yes.
And when you see from the perspective of pure goodness, that's when you actually see.
Yes.
So therefore, then that works easier, is that from the platform of pure goodness, you explain using examples in goodness.
Yes.
And if that doesn't work, then you toss in some passionate ignorance, whatever will make it, you know. Accessible by whoever you're talking to.
Like that.
But it has to be based on that principle of goodness, otherwise then they won't catch it. Because they're using words, but there's a meaning to it. So it's not actually the words. That's why later the words can be used for something else.
Yes. Yeah, come on.
You know, like I was saying, you know, like there was two devotees, and it was like summertime, right? And they were sitting in that, and somehow they're talking, and the one devotee says, "Wow, that's cool." And the other devotee said, "No, it's not. It's summer. It's you know, 40 degrees. What do you mean it's cool?"
Yes.
You know, because in other words, he wasn't going to acknowledge, why don't you say it's nice or it's good, or, you know, why you say it's cool. Because cool means temperature.
Yeah.
You understand? But the point is how people use it, it has other meaning. And there's a feeling what cool is. Does that make sense? And so that's, and then you use that word, and then people catch on, then they understand that, then it has meaning. But then it moves on. And some other word will mean that. So that's the point. It's theoretical. Because that will change, but that feeling you're trying to express, that won't change. So Krishna is the real thing that's trying to be expressed. And so the natural forms are the ones that are best expressing it, and the natural place where you can always see Krishna very easily. You go from that, you distort it, it becomes harder to see, but it's still going to, the potency is there. So that's why you try to use the more clear ones. Because people, they start to become educated.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. 7. The whole intellectual and moral philosophy is explained by matter itself. All spiritual ideas are pictures from the material world, because matter is a dictionary of spirit. And material pictures are but the shadows of the spiritual affairs, which are material eyes. Eye carries back to our spiritual perception. So we're seeing it through the material, but we're bringing it back into the spiritual. Because the soul is spiritual. And if you want to understand the devotional service, then you have to do that through the spiritual mind, the spiritual senses, all this. But we're using the material senses to bring that back through. Right? Does that make sense? So then you can see Krishna in everything, and everything in Krishna, and you appreciate that with the spiritual platform, though you're using the material senses. Does that make sense? So we see, as it's been very nicely said here, and people will catch that, yes, I can understand, I can appreciate the spiritual by what I see around me in this world. They'll only look at it from that, and it's familiar to them, or, you know, it has that aspect of nature and other things like that. They're not catching the point that Krishna is non-different from everything.
Mm.
Everything is Krishna.
Mm.
But the point is having accepted this point, then gradually, as they become purified, they can appreciate that. That's why you use the philosophy all the way along. Samanda Abhideya Prayojana is always used. Then as someone matures, they start to see deeper and deeper meanings of that, because the idea is you're going deep into the study. Because otherwise it's shallow, it's just words. You understand? So that's why, you know, it comes up. If a word is used and then we doubt the word and immediately have a doubt about that, without thinking, does this word have any other things, what does that relate to and all that, then that's shallow. Right? You know, it's just like we see as the six schools of philosophy, they're shallow. They may go a little deeper and more, a little bit more technical than other schools. But the point is, it's still shallow because they have a way the word is used, and that's the only way you can use the word. Right? You can't see how Krishna is all those things. He's that principle that all these words are based on. That takes thought.
Yes.
Right? So that means that it has to be applied, because we're in the section of application. So manana has to be applied. Then one starts to understand. But if one thinks, no, simply through the theoretical and just by the hearing of the words themselves, that won't give me understanding, then we actually haven't understood what knowledge is. Because knowledge is Krishna. It's not the words. The words are the medium through which they're expressed. So, 8. God in His infinite goodness and kindness has established this unfailing connection between the truth and the shadow in order to impress upon us the eternal truth which He has reserved for us. So, you see is that the original and the shadow, they're connected. And they work in the same way. Just the original has something's accomplished that's real, and the shadow not. Does that make sense? Yeah. So it's Krishna's kindness that He's made this connection. Because the point is it's His energy. He has the one original energy, but then that takes on the grosser form as the material energy. But it's one energy. Right? And so then taking on these forms, then those who are in this gross matter, they're working with the reflection, right, in the gross form. But then from that, then it can go back to the original. Right? So by using what's here, because it has that reflection from there, you can use it as examples to get at the absolute truth. Right? Yes. The clock explains the time. The alphabet points to the gathered store of knowledge. The beautiful song of a harmonium gives the idea of eternal harmony in the spiritual world. Today and tomorrow and the day after tomorrow. And thus thrusts us into the ungrasped idea of eternity. Like right? As we say, you know, tomorrow, day after tomorrow, like that. It starts to take us forward towards the eternal principle. Yeah. Huh. So does that mean the Mexicans are quite, moving forward, they're progressive towards eternity. Yeah, so then you take that essential point from there. Maybe not the Abhideya, but the... Yeah. Similarly, material pictures impress upon our spiritual nature the truly spiritual idea of religion. Right, so the pictures are there, they're made out of paint and all that, but it impresses upon us the transcendental. Because the potency there is Krishna. And it's His nature, so He can manifest there. But it's manifest through His energy. Right? Krishna is always manifesting through His internal potency. You appreciate the eternal potency, then the picture will show you Krishna. You don't appreciate the internal potency, then the picture won't show you Krishna. You'll just think He's some, you know, Indian guy that made a lot of trouble, you know. 9. It is on these reasonable grounds that Vyasa adopted the mode of explaining our spiritual worship with some sort of material phenomena, which correspond with the spiritual truth. Right. So therefore, the Panchanga Nyaya. It means your example means you're using a material phenomena to explain, give an example of the spiritual truth, because there's a connection. But that's why then a specific example and a specific way of appreciating it is to be used. You can't use that example in other ways. But it applies in a specific way.
But knowledge is also true only for people who accept Krishna as God.
Yeah, it's revealed. But the point is anything like that is if you don't, let's say, if you don't accept, let's say, the modern academy, can you get a degree in that academy? No. You know, so if you don't accept the concept of economics and money and its value, can you work in that field? Right? But, as it said, the actual practical thing that makes it work is Krishna. So, in any case, it's always about faith. It's just what aspect of Krishna you have faith in. You know? So is it you know Brahman Paramatma or Bhagavan, or even and then you see many is Brahman means it's these three, but if you're not accepting, you're not theistic, then it will just be the Brahman aspect.
Yes.
But you don't know it's Brahman, so you're just accepting that the laws of nature.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't properly respect the laws of nature, you get no results. And because you respect those laws and follow those laws, they call themselves scientists. But because they're impersonalists, therefore they oppose the idea of God being in control. Though they say there's laws of nature. So we're dealing with they may have a seeming intelligence, mechanical intelligence, but we're still dealing with boys just that have whiskers.
Mm-hmm.
That's the problem, is that there's not really applying their intelligence into what's practical.
Mm-hmm. But you see that it is difficult to connect our value with our activity. So sometimes.
But that value itself is Krishna. So when you see the value in connection with Krishna, then you're actually getting something.
Yes.
But if you don't see Krishna in connection with that value, then there's a problem.
Yes.
So. Ten. In the Bhagavad, we have been advised, and now we're back to
the
continuing. Okay. Maybe you should put what do you call it? Just put Abhideya continued or something. A little brackets or something. In the Bhagavat, we have been advised, first of all, to convert ourselves into most grateful servants of God as regards our relation to our fellow brethren. Our nature has been described as bearing three different phases: goodness, passion, and ignorance. Goodness is that property in our nature which is purely good as far as it can be pure in our present state. Passion is neither good nor bad. Ignorance is evil. It is our object to train up our affections and tendencies to the standard of goodness. Right? Like you mentioned before. But the purpose of that is to go to pure goodness. So goodness means what is the actual standard, but doing that for Krishna. That's the difference. So the being situated in goodness doesn't change. What changes is whether it's being done for Krishna or not done for Krishna. 11. We are then to look at all living entities in the same light in which we look at to ourselves, i.e. we must convert our selfishness into all possible disinterested activity towards all around us.
Mm-hmm.
Love, charity, good deeds, and devotion to God will be our only aim. Right? But it's not about love for love's sake, charity for charity, good deeds for good deeds. It's about devotion to Krishna. And that's expressed through these other things. Does that make sense? So all the social platitudes that people want in the world, that they make their social systems and their philosophies and all their endeavors, is all already included in bhakti. Because bhakti is expressed through these. But they themselves aren't bhakti. You know, just as the pot is not cooking. Cooking is a separate entity. The pot can observe cooking through the pot. But the pot itself does not define cooking. Yeah? So it's the same thing. Is that all these good deeds and nice things, they're all there, you know, in mode of goodness, because Krishna gave them to be used to serve him.
Mm-hmm.
So if they're used not to serve him, then why would that be? It's not actually goodness. It'll be mixed because it'll have some passion or ignorance. Because you're doing it for your own benefit, or you're doing it without understanding its connection to God, so therefore it takes on these qualities.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Does that mean? And if those two things increase more, then it drops out of goodness. Right? But pure goodness means it has none of those motives. We then become the servants of God by obeying his high and holy wishes. Right? So the Icha Shakti. Here we begin to be bhaktas. All this is covered by the term Abhideya, the second cardinal point in the supreme religion. Because right? Your cardinal points is where, you know, that's the direction you're going. So here, come servants of God by obeying his high and holy wishes. Right? In other words, you know, we're engaged in devotional service to please Krishna. Right? So he's the Lord of the Ichashakti. So therefore we use the jnana and kriya. Right? Those positions of our knowledge and activities to please the Lord. You understand? See the language he used. But he's not saying something different. You understand? We're just trying to impress that soft preaching. Then if we're using it to mean that we don't say anything about Krishna and all this and avoid the philosophy, then we should just say soft, don't use the word preaching. But if our intent is to preach, but we want to do so in a cultured or a gentle way, we still then have to use the philosophy. But we just use words and terminology and examples that who we're talking to will appreciate. Right? But seeing that that is being defined as that is what is preaching, you don't have to call it hard or soft. Right? Does that make sense? So, because hard or soft means it's not about Krishna. It's not about preaching. It's about the words. And so in the one, I say the words, I don't adjust it for the individual. The other is I adjust for the individual, but I don't actually have the content. So both of them, it's the words without the content. One, we're using traditional words and examples, but no content. The other one, we're not using traditional words, but without the content. So they're both Niyamagraha. So what's being given here, this is the actual position of how preaching works, how teaching works. Prayojana. What is the object of our spiritual development? Our prayer, our devotion, and our union with God. The Bhagavad tells us that the object is not enjoyment or sorrow, but continual progress in spiritual holiness and harmony. 2. In the commonplace books of the Hindu religion, we have descriptions of a local heaven and a local hell. The heaven as beautiful as anything on earth, and the hell as ghastly as any picture of evil. Besides this heaven, we have many more places where good souls are sent up in the way of promotion. There are 84 divisions of the hell itself, some more dreadful than the one Milton has described in his Paradise Lost. Right, so, you know. Yeah. In other words, you know, whatever you think it is, there's ones that are worse. Right. Controversial passages concerning descriptions of hell, etc. So this is a sub. Bhagavat certainly tells us of a state of reward and punishment in the future according to deeds performed in our present situation. All poetic inventions beside this spiritual fact have been described as statements borrowed from other works in the way of preservation of old traditions in the book, which superseded them and put an end to the necessity of their storage. If the whole stock of Hindu theological works which preceded the Bhagavat were burnt, like the Alexandrian library, and the sacred Bhagavat alone was preserved as it is, not a part of the philosophy of the Hindus, except that of the atheistic sects, would be lost. The Bhagavat, therefore, may be styled both as religious work and a compendium of all Hindu history and philosophy. Okay, continues this. 5. The Bhagavad does not allow its followers to ask anything from God except eternal love towards Him. The kingdom of God, the kingdom of the world, the beauties of the local heavens, and the sovereignty over the material world are never the subjects of Vaishnava prayer. Right? So there's no interest in material gain. 6. The Vaishnava meekly and humble says, Father, Master, God, friend, and husband of my soul, hallowed be thy name. I do not approach you for anything which you have already given me. I have sinned against you, and I now repent and solicit your pardon. Let thy holiness touch my soul and make me free from grossness. Let my spirit be devoted meekly to your holy service in absolute love towards thee. 7. I have called you my God, and let my soul be wrapped up in admiration at your greatness. I have addressed you as my master, and let my soul be strongly devoted to your service. I have called you my friend, and let my soul be in reverential love towards you, and not in dread or fear. I have called you my husband, and let my spiritual nature be in eternal union with you, forever loving and never dreading or feeling disgust. Father, let me have strength enough to go up to you as the consort of my soul, so that we may be one in eternal love, peace to the world. 8. The Vaishnava does not expect to be king of a certain part of the universe after his death, nor does he dread a local fiery and turbulent hell. Nor is his idea of salvation the total annihilation of personal existence. The Vaishnava is the meekest of all creatures, devoid of all ambition. He wants to serve God spiritually after death, as he has served him both in spirit and matter while here. His constitution is spiritual, and his highest object of life is divine and holy love. Right? So he sees that this is then the goal that one wants. So in other words, the pure devotion, as Rupa Goswami is explaining. Right?
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Hare Hare.
Jai Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivinda ki, Jai Nitai Gaura Premanandini.